This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca.
Wings thanks Rabble Podcast Network for carrying our programs and urges listeners to contribute to their fundraiser. Please visit rabble.ca/donate today. Today from the Wings Archives.
Any woman who talks for more than about 25 to 33% of the time when talking to a man is seen to dominate the conversation.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
There's a problem in discussing the issue of women-only space. For as soon as you start to say events for women only, cafes for women only, discussions for women only, or even worse, programs, courses, or classes for women only in the university, there's a predictable reaction. And not just for the men who don't like it and won't have it, and for all sorts of reasons insist that men should be allowed entry, but often from women who feel guilty, uncomfortable, in the wrong when they take a stand that could be interpreted as excluding men.
Dr. Dale Spender, an Australian by birth, is now one of the most eminent and prolific feminist scholars in Britain. In 1989, she toured the U.S., addressing herself to the question, why women-only spaces are necessary. To support her thesis, she talked about her own research and experiences, starting with what happened when she arrived at the University of London 25 years ago. She had enrolled to do a doctorate on women and language, but found that the reigning linguistics experts had pronouncements, but no data on women. Dr. Dale Spender.
All I could do to get some data was to start making tapes of women and men talking. And on this basis, I was going to start making characteristics of women's talk. Nobody else had done it at this stage. I figured that was a good thing to do. So I became the most unethical tape recordist that London ever found. I went everywhere with my tape recorder, and where I couldn't go, I planted the tape recorder and picked it up later. I took it to staff meetings, I took it to professional associations, I took it to dinner parties. I planted it where my mother and father were having private conversations. I mean, they're the ones I'll admit to. I've just put that tape recorder everywhere, trying to get a range of conversations between women and men. And after I'd done this for about 6 months and had masses of tapes, I thought, okay, what I do now is start listening to these tapes and start making a list of the characteristics of the talk of women. I can clearly remember the evening when I sat down with a tape and a sheet of paper in front of me and just listened to the tape, and I was going to make characteristics of women's talk. And I listened to the tape. It was a 45-minute tape. And at the end, I got a page of doodles. And I thought, that's funny. You know, there's just not enough on that to even make any statements about women. Okay, so I played another tape, 45 minutes, listening all the time to start hearing women talk and to write down things about women's talk. I thought, goodness me, that's two bad choices. And I listened to a third tape. And I think, you know, by midnight, goodness me, this is amazing. All I've got is, really? Goodness me, did you? Isn't that interesting? And at the time, I didn't think you'd be able to do a PhD on But since then, I've thought it could have been the most amazing PhD ever to have done it on and what women are doing in conversations with men. And for me, of course, this represented an enormous complex of puzzles. In the first place, I mean, I had completely accepted that women were the talkative sex, when every day I'd been confronted by abundant evidence to the contrary, that it was men who were doing the talking and women who were not only doing the listening but who were encouraging men to talk. And of course then I started to make lists of characteristics of the interaction. The first thing, you know, you find is, of course, that men dominate the conversation on any sort of level that you want to make it, whether it's about the content, whether it's about the direction it takes, the tone, the particular emphasis it's given. Men perform 98% of the interruptions, and I define an interruption as a sort of non sequitur, which takes the conversation away and sends it off on another track. And listening to the conversations of women and men, you could put any one of 100 responses in for the woman, and the man would still make the same sort of comment. And you hear this, I mean, even some of the most intimate discussions that I've taped, and you hear a woman say, you know, oh God, had a really awful day today, and the man says things like, we had to sack someone too, and you realise it's got nothing to do with her world, nothing to do with anything that she might say, but totally a comment about his world, what he's trying to do. And there's no reversal of that. I mean, it's not that you can find out that it happens the other way. Men do not make comments that women do not attend to and go off and say their own thing. Well, if they are, they're being really nasty, if that's what they're doing. And of course, the other thing I started to find is that the most common statement that men make in interactions with women is a variation on the theme of, what you mean is. And the only other group of people who do that on a regular basis are school teachers, who say, what you mean is, when students bring experience into the classroom that the teachers don't want to take on as it is, but change into classroom type experience. And this is very interesting. I mean, you expect school teachers to do that, but to find that men and women, where they think, or they would call themselves peers, that men do that, which is actually claiming a more privileged way of knowing and understanding, and that you have more authority, and that you say what you mean is, or I think you'll find that. That's if they're polite. I mean, sometimes they just say, this is how it is, or you don't live in the real world. Things like that that are constantly going on. And of course, another thing which interests me enormously, and which I've taken up a great deal in relation to the written word, but started off with the spoken word, and that is, you know, a woman making a contribution, saying something, and it's as if she didn't exist. I mean, as if she'd never spoken. And 3 minutes later, the same idea being taken up by a man. I mean, every woman knows this one. The idea being taken up by a man, and everybody's saying, goodness me, isn't that it? Oh, yes, that's really great. And of course, I want to know, do they not hear the first time? I mean, this is too great for the law of coincidence. They must have heard it. And when you say to men, and I say all the time, I mean, goodness me, she said that 3 minutes ago. What do you mean by saying it now? You didn't take any notice 3 minutes ago. Did you steal that? When you start asking questions about whether or not it's coincidence or theft or appropriation, I mean, you're really in a very complex area of what's going on. You also find that in women's conversation, it's very important for everyone to have a turn. And I've done lots and lots of experiments with this. A group of women, taking one, giving her a tape recorder, asking her not to talk, sending them off and saying, will you have a discussion? And then afterwards asking them a series of questions. Was there anyone who didn't talk? In a group of up to 15 or 20, women are about 100% attentive to someone not talking. And when you actually speak to the person who didn't talk, I mean, she's found it excruciatingly painful, because it's not just that people have actually made comments about, do you want to say anything, but it's all that eye contact with women looking at her to see if she's all right and does she want to say anything and is everything okay. And there's huge attention to everyone talking. And women will actually define a good conversation as one where everyone has a turn. Women are also extremely good at reporting on the sequence of events and what went on in a conversation, partly because they use the people who spoke. So they'll say things like, well, Judy said this and Pauline said that, and then Sonia said, no, it wasn't Sonia said this, someone else said that. And they'll actually go around, so they use the speaker as a marker because they are attentive to who's doing the speaking. And that's very interesting too. Get a group of men to do it, and I haven't done it nearly as often because it's really boring, but you get a group of men to do it, and the first thing that happens is 100% inaccuracy about who didn't speak. Men are totally inattentive to who didn't speak. They're quite good sometimes at who did speak, but they're excellent when they speak, because that's the point of it. And men are just appalling at remembering the sequence of events or what went on in a conversation. Well, I think we need a new word there. Men are actually appalling when they're each pontificating in a group. But I think this is also about this notion of intuition in women. I mean, I don't think there's any grounds for saying women are more intuitive than men. I think they just listen to what's going on, and men miss most of it, and their only explanation is to say women have got intuition because they actually heard what was happening. And the way in which you can get women to talk about the dynamics of a group that men couldn't even begin to understand, I mean, that's one of the points I want to make tonight. Pamela Fishman has said that women are supposed to be good at the art of conversation, and the art of conversation is getting men to talk generally about themselves. And there's even a body posture that goes with it. It's not just that it's a whole thing about the angle of the head and goodness me, did you really? And yet what this means about having males who are taller is really quite phenomenal. You can't do that with shorter men. I mean, I think if we want a revolution and you want men, you get shorter ones. There's no other way of doing it. Shorter, younger and poorer, and let them take care of themselves, and that's the revolution as far as I can see. It would make a huge difference to women to actually talk down to men instead of talking up all the time. And I've done some studies in restaurants where no matter how tall a woman is, and that no matter what damage it does to her backbone, every woman who sits in a restaurant is lower than any man that she's talking to. Women are so careful of men's egos. If a man says something stupid, if a man says something that's embarrassing or awkward, droves of women come in and pick him up and dust him down and preserve his ego, save face, gloss over it, fix it up, in a way in which I don't even think that men are aware of. And this is one of the things I wonder about too, because if I hear a man say something stupid, I ask him to repeat it, and I usually tape it. I think it's a much better policy. Very good data. And that's what I'm in the business of doing. But I do see, and have seen, even in the last 4 weeks, where women get uncomfortable about some of the things that I'm saying on behalf of the men. And you can see that sort of trying to make it easier for them, even making comments and questions that are meant to include the men so that they will not feel in any way not the centre of attention or have their feelings hurt. Having their feelings hurt seems to be something that's rather important for men. It doesn't seem to matter so much for women, which is really interesting, given that men aren't supposed to have feelings and we're the ones who are. The other thing, of course, is women's listening habits. Listening, I don't see as a passive activity at all. This actually upsets me, that in language and linguistics research, 95% of the research that's done is done on talking, and less than 5% is done on listening, because men are still in charge of the research agenda and they very much follow their own preoccupations, with the result that we know very, very little about the complexity of listening. And there's all sorts of listening that women do that's very, very supportive and helpful and therapeutic and warming, which encourages relationships and builds relationships. And I think it's one of the most active things that women do. It's part of women's gossip in a way. I don't know how many of you know, but the origin of the word gossip is a talking comforter who talked you through the birth. And in lots of ways, I think women's gossip is still talking comfort, getting you through things, getting over things, sorting the world out, getting things into place. And I think it's a real skill that women have got that is part of our sanity in some ways. And in fact, one that I think all human beings should have access to, but I think half of them should find out for themselves how to do it. I don't think it's our role to necessarily teach them. And the last thing that I'm going to bring up about women talking to men, and why, of course, we've got good arguments for women wanting women-only space. I mean, if women want to talk, they've got to talk to each other. There's not much chance in the presence of men. Is this notion of a fair share of the conversation. And this has intrigued me, you see. How could I believe that women were the talkative sex and still have all this contrary evidence that women talk so little? This was really important to me. Basically now I believe that any woman who talks for more than about 25 to 33% of the time, it's in that framework, is seen to dominate the conversation when talking to a man. And I suppose if women aren't expected to talk at all, you open your mouth and you're talking too much. So I think that comes into it. But one of the things I tried to do was to sort out what perceptions there are that women have about this. And I've got some really fierce feminist friends in London, University of London, who said, look, time might have been when we were deferential to men. It might have been the case 20 years ago that when a man entered the group, you know, we would change, but it wouldn't happen now. So I gleefully planted my tape recorder and set up to see what was happening with these women talking to men at the University of London whom they called their peers. I planted the tape recorder in all sorts of places and went up afterwards and said, you know, I've been taping you. Can I count the minutes? Well, I said I was only interested in counting the minutes, but I found out all sorts of wonderful things listening to some of those tapes, which I can recommend to anybody if you want to know what's going on in the university. You just plant a few tapes like that. But you have to count the minutes with the people there or they won't believe you. So, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, 5 minutes is about the maximum you want of the conversation to go through it with people. And the only question I asked these women was, do you think you had a fair share of the conversation? And without exception, they said, yes, they thought they had had a fair share of the conversation. I mean, they took pride in having a fair share of the conversation. And, I mean, nearly all the men, you said, you have a fair share. And as if it's supposed to be funny and I'm supposed to fall about laughing, they say, oh, she had more than her share. You know, women are the talkative sex again. And when we analysed those tapes, and I had 16 in the end, some of them I wasn't allowed to use because they wouldn't let me listen to their private conversations, and some of them I pretended to erase. Listen to them first, right? All sorts of naughty things like that. But no woman got beyond the 30% mark in any of those. And there were women who were having as little as 10 and 12% reporting that they had a fair share of the conversation. Now, of course, one of the things I've tried to do is to talk half the time in the presence of a man. And, well, because I've set myself a mandatory limit of 3 minutes, I have to report that I'm an absolute total failure, because no man's ever stayed the 3 minutes. But I have got to 2 and a quarter on a couple of occasions before you see this man stalk off saying, she's absolutely impossible, she never listens to a word you say, absolutely terrible. And of course, that's what you feel like too. I mean, trying to talk for half the time in the presence of a man is not to be recommended unless you have very good sort of stress levels in it that you can rely on. Because what happens is you start talking and a man will interrupt. And if you want to get that floor for 50% of the time, you have to keep talking when he interrupts, and you won't go very long before he interrupts again. And if you want to keep the floor, you're just going to have to keep talking. And so by the time you finish, you feel as though you've been really rude and overbearing and aggressive, etc. And even so, the maximum I've ever done is 42%. That's the highest I've ever got on the 2 and a quarter minutes when they've walked off and said she doesn't even listen to a word you say. And this has happened to me in looking at interviewers as well. Years ago, I wouldn't be interviewed by men, partly because, you know, I was never asked genuine questions. I was set up in such a way that I was going to be exposed as being very silly or misrepresented, because everybody knows how stupid feminists are, and that's what the point of the interview was. And so then for a while I refused to be interviewed by men, and this became a story in itself, which seemed to me not a very good story to be put around. So I decided I had to find some way of being interviewed by men and holding the cards. So I'll be interviewed by men whenever they like, because what I do is take my tape recorder along, plonk it down next to me and say, I'm doing research on what poor interviewers men are, and turn my tape recorder on and let them ask me my questions, you see. And it's amazing how it changes things. And also, of course, gives me a record for whether or not I'm going to be misinterpreted or misquoted, because I've got my own record. And I mean, in fact, a couple of men won't interview me now, which I think is a much better thing when you say they won't interview me. But in fact, I was doing research on what poor interviewers men were at one stage. What was happening in Australia? at this stage, a number of women newscasters actually got the sack on the grounds that they were not doing their job. And what I started to do was to make tapes and get tapes, particularly the unedited ones. Sometimes the news clips on the news itself are just too short to do anything of, but there's a much longer tape that you can have a look at. And basically it seems to me that men define an interview situation as one of confrontation. You bamboozle someone, you get them off guard, you get them to admit something that they didn't want to say anyway. And of course, whenever I'm interviewed by men like that, your guard's up all the time. You're very careful about what you say. You think very carefully before you say it. You won't answer some questions. And it's very obvious that this is an interviewing technique. That's how it's seen. Now, when women ask questions, they quite frequently use eliciting skills. I mean, they're so disarming when they start asking you questions in such a pleasant, conversational and eliciting way. They elicit some of the admissions and confessions that you'd never get out of someone who's confrontational. But then the people who are rating them at the TV stations see the women as lucky for having got that, because they don't see any skill in what the women did to get it. So weren't the women lucky to get that story? Oh yeah, she's so-and-so, she got, you know, this guy just happened to spill the beans and, you know, she bloody lucky she was there at the time. And no appreciation whatsoever of the skills that go into that. And of course, when I've looked up the research on this and the research on women's skills, there's almost nothing. I mean, all the things I'm talking to you about tonight, and women's skills, conversational skills, in the entire academic literature of the Western world, there wouldn't be more than 10 papers on any of this. And yet it's women's daily lives and reality. Recently I've gone to try and find out how old boys have to be before they start to have this enormous intolerance to listen to good things about girls. And I've gone to some preschools where I've started to talk to 3-year-olds about good things that girls have done. And it takes about 3 minutes for 3-year-old boys to say, no, 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 girls can't do that, girls can't do that, to knock the book out of my hand. And of course what they're doing is rigidly adhering to the rules of what they've learned. Boys do things in the world, girls don't. And I find that really devastating, that's there. I think some people would be absolutely staggered at the level of abuse that 15 and 16-year-old boys direct towards 15 and 16-year-old girls. I mean, it's absolutely appalling. And I've certainly been told that it's just as bad in, maybe not so much in the classrooms, but the general ethos in colleges, the sorts of statements that are made about girls all the time. And of course no one these days would refute that single-sex schools are better places for girls. Of course they're not very good for boys, which is why we've got mixed-sex schools. But in a couple of places in Britain they actually took the girls out for single-sex maths and science classes to see how they would go. And the girls did brilliantly well. And the boys, of course, their results went down. And so after 2 years the experiment was cancelled on the grounds that you couldn't play around with boys' success in maths and science. So they went back to a situation where it's the girls who are having their results lowered so that the boys can continue to have the good results. One of the reasons for this, you see, is that in a single-sex boys' school, a group of pseudo-girls is created. A group of pseudo-girls who are called pufters, etc., and who are treated like girls are usually treated in a mixed-sex school, and because they're boys, they actually reduce the boys' average to have those in the class. And so when you get a group of girls in, you can actually elevate those boys. So it's the girls who get most of the harassment. You'll still get a couple of boys who will be associated with the girls and who'll come into that. But that's the sort of dynamic that's going on there. And, you know, I think that if girls want to, well, I don't know if I think if girls want to learn, they should do it on without the presence of boys, because one of the things that's very clear is that if girls do as well as they do with so little teacher attention, I mean, I've done lots of experiments where girls get less than 10% of teacher attention, then what it indicates is that girls are taking responsibility for their own learning. The other thing I think that's quite interesting is about the way boys demand to be taught, the way boys keep saying, I'm the centre of attention, you're the teacher, you teach me, because I think that's one of the things that's also things are happening in women's studies classes at the moment. And certainly as I've spoken the last 4 weeks, I've had men stand up and just, you know, shaking and shout at me that we'll never get anywhere without them. And and that what we need to do is to... one man who stood there shouting at me, "I'm a sensitive man. You should be welcoming me into your ranks. This is ridiculous. You'll never get anywhere without me. And I'm a sensitive man." And this whole notion of you can't go off and teach each other. What about us? Why aren't we included? And the last little bit that I want to talk about is about the reflecting men bit. I mean, all of these bits so far are different books that I've written, as I'm sure you'll know, that every time I've got a new question, I mean, my way of financing the research is to get the advance from the publisher, not that it does finance the research. But the thing about reflecting men are at twice their natural size, which comes from a statement of Virginia Woolf's that for centuries women have served as looking glasses for men, reflecting them at twice their natural size. And Sally Klein and I went around and interviewed 300 women, a very representative sample, everyone who talked to us, and asked them what they did to reflect men. And the first thing that happened was, I mean, there wasn't a single woman who said, "What do you mean?" There's also a chapter in the book called The Mandatory Smile and the Obligatory Orgasm, which tells you what many of them responded instantly. I mean, the things that women told us about reflecting men and the ways in which women spend so much of their time trying to get men to talk, trying to look after men, trying to make them feel good. And I think there are very good reasons for this. I mean, I think women are actually frightened of men, and that one way of managing men is to keep them feeling good, because if they don't feel good, they might behave very badly. And certainly it fitted in very closely with some of the things that women said about male violence. We actually had women say that if they'd managed him better, this wouldn't have happened. I mean, by the same token, my mother says that she's done it all her life. I mean, I've seen her manage my father year in, year out. She's done it all her life because, in fact, it does promote a harmonious situation. It does promote a context in which the family can still meet. If she hadn't done it, we wouldn't still meet. And I can clearly remember one night when I was trying to say to my father, "You know, Mum works all the time. There's no time off from emotional management. Every time we meet here as a family, Mum's putting in all the hours on keeping things going, as well as actually doing the cooking and the cleaning up." My father saying, "You know, this is not true. There's no sexism in our house. Only equality here. What on earth are you talking about?" And me arguing more and more, and him arguing more and more, and the voices getting louder and louder, and my mother suddenly saying, "Would anyone like dessert?" And me saying to Dad, "See, that's what she's doing right now. That's what she's doing." And my father looking at me saying, "Dale, she asked you, do you want dessert? Dessert is not a feminist issue. What on earth are you talking about?" And of course, no way of being able to explain to him that here's a whole repertoire of women's skills that are being used day in and day out to keep the relationships going, to keep the family going. And my mother's doing it all the time. No one, my father's not doing it for my mother. There's no way my father does those things for my mother. He's a very nice father, and my mother would say he's been an adequate husband, but there's no way that he does those sorts of things or looks after her in those sorts of ways. And even now when he makes the bed, he's got to be thanked, because that's how you keep them feeling good.
You've been listening to excerpts from a talk by Dr. Dale Spender, editor of the Women's Studies International Forum magazine of London and author and editor of at least 15 books. Her most recent book published in the U.S. is titled, "The Writing or the Sex?" or "Why You Don't Have to Read Women's Writing to Know It's No Good." Other titles include "Reflecting Men at Twice Their Natural Size," "Women of Ideas and What Men Have Done to Them," and "Time and Tide Wait for No Man." Dale Spender spoke April 28, 1989, at New College in San Francisco. The tape of her talk was edited for Wings by Frieda Worden.
Thanks to our supporters, including your community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book, The Gift in the Heart of Language, The Maternal Source of Meaning. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.